As our nation's Supreme Court considers two pivotal cases concerning same-sex marriage this week, the Iowa Supreme Court is also grappling with major issues that will affect the way we as Iowans live, love, and work. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we welcome back two University of Iowa law school professors, Song Richardson and Todd Pennis. A few weeks ago, they joined us to preview key cases before the nation's highest court. And today, they'll tell us about four high-profile cases this session before Iowa's Supreme Court. We'll also be joined by legal blogger and litigator Ryan Copeland. That's all coming up right after a look at this hour's news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As our nation's Supreme Court considers two pivotal cases concerning same-sex marriage this week, we've heard a lot about that in the news. The Iowa Supreme Court is also grappling with major issues that will affect the way we, as Iowans, live, love, and work. And today, we welcome back two University of Iowa law school professors. Todd Pettis is the Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Song Richardson, Professor of Criminal Law, also at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd and Song, welcome back to our program.
Thanks very much for asking us.
Thank you.
A few weeks ago, many of our listeners, I'm sure, will remember you joined us to preview key cases before the nation's court. We talked at that point about DOMA and Proposition 8. We'll pick up with that in a moment, but today we'll also talk about Iowa's Supreme Court cases, four high-profile cases there. Also joining us to do that, Ryan Copemans. He is an attorney in Nymaster Goods Litigation Department, also editor-in-chief of the Iowa appellate blog On Brief. Ryan is in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And Nymaster Goods is in Des Moines?
Correct.
Okay, very good. Wanted to make sure we got your location correct. Let's start off. Before we get to the Iowa Supreme Court cases, I'd like to get a tap your legal minds to get your observation. Yesterday, DOMA was tried at the U.S. Supreme Court. On Tuesday, the day before, the court heard whether Proposition 8 was constitutional. I'd like to turn to your legal minds to get your observations. We've heard a lot of analysis over the last few days. And let me start with you, Todd Pettis. What have you heard about how these cases may turn out?
Okay, well, just to be clear, there are, of course, two cases, one coming out of California, and the question in the California case is, does it violate the federal constitution for California to deny same-sex couples the right to marry? The second case, which is called Windsor, after the plaintiff in that case, Edith Windsor, and the issue there has to do with DOMA, and DOMA is the legislation that President Clinton signed when he was in office, the Defense of Marriage Act, and it has a couple different provisions. The provision that's at issue in this litigation is the part that says the federal government defines marriage as being between a man and a woman, and so if you are a same-sex married couple, you don't get any of the federal benefits that ordinarily would come with marriage. And, you know, I think the national mainstream press has done a great job of reporting on this case and the quick version of their account, which I think is right, having listened to the oral argument. And by the way, if listeners are interested, they can go to the Supreme Court's website and listen to the audio of the oral arguments for themselves. If you have any interest in this, it's great fun and good to hear the personalities behind some of the names. Quickly, I think the conventional wisdom says that the odds are pretty good. The court's going to strike down the contested part of DOMA and say, as in Edith Windsor's case, that she has some tax money coming back to her that she wouldn't have had to pay in the first place if her spouse had been a man. And I think the conventional wisdom is probably right in the California case, which is that we're not likely to see a majority of justices reach an agreement one way or the other. I think there's going to be a lot of reluctance to jump in on that issue right now. And there's several different ways they could go to avoid answering the big question. And they're going to disagree on which of those other ways they can roads they should take, but they're going to be looking for other roads, I think, than just coming to a grand conclusion about the same-sex marriage issue.
Ryan Copemans, I wonder if you can help us out with the implications for us in Iowa, these two cases, one in California, one out east, if same-sex couples here in Iowa will be affected by these U.S. Supreme Court How possibly?
Well, they will by the DOMA case. We already have same-sex marriage here in Iowa because of Varnum. And the Prop 8 case, which is challenging California's ban on same-sex marriage, will not apply here and will not affect us in Iowa. Unless, of course, the legislature, again, gets back into the business of trying to pass a constitutional amendment, which seems to be ever increasingly unlikely. So the question for Iowans is DOMA, because same-sex couples here receive all the state benefits, well, many state benefits. They can get married here. But as Todd said, they don't receive the federal benefits. So that's the one they're going to be watching closely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Song Richardson, you're a professor of criminal law, but I wonder if you had any observations, anything that hadn't been mentioned that you'd like to throw in before we go to the Iowa cases.
So the one interesting thing I wanted to follow up that Todd mentioned is the court might attempt to avoid ruling on the merits in this case. And one way that they might try to do that is to say that the federal government has the authority to regulate, I mean, the states have the authority to regulate marriage, not the federal government.
In the DOMA case.
In the DOMA case, exactly. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about that is if Justice Kennedy seems to hold that position. And what's interesting is if the court does go in that direction, it has implications for the Proposition 8 case, because then if it's the states have the authority to regulate marriage, does that mean that California then has the authority to pass Proposition 8? So the two cases may be related.
Okay, we'll stand by and look for that ruling, what the decisions handed out early summer, Todd?
Yeah, well, we probably won't hear from the court on these cases till the end of June.
Till the end of June. Okay, let's move on to some Iowa Supreme Court cases that are in our highest court here in Iowa. And Todd, I'd like to start off with you. We have a couple of civil cases chosen and a couple of criminal cases. Let's begin with you, Todd, in the civil cases. Because this links up to same-sex marriage, Gartner v. Iowa Department of Public Health, one of the first cases to come as a result of Iowa legalizing same-sex marriage. Tell us the story behind this case.
Right. Well, it's an interesting story. It involves a couple, Heather and Melissa Gartner. I gather they've been in a relationship for a long time, and some years ago they decided to have a child together, which they did, and they then went through adoption proceedings so that both the birth mother and then the then partner are both legal parents. They decided then to have a second child using, as they had the first time, an anonymous sperm donor. And while after that child was conceived, the court came down with Varnum versus Breann. Varnum versus Breann was the case in April of 2009 where the Iowa Supreme Court held that same-sex couples had a right to marry. And so just a couple months after that decision came down, Heather and Melissa got married. And just a couple months after that, the second child was born. So while they were in the hospital, they, like other new parents, filled out the forms that you're asked to fill out in order to get a birth certificate, where they ask questions about the parents. And they filled them out not only for the birth mother, Heather, but also for Melissa, saying, we're married, this is our child. So they filled out the questionnaire for both parents, sent it into the state, and waited for the birth certificate to come back. And when it came back, it was, in their view, half completed. The information about Heather being the mother was there, but where the birth certificate has room for the other parent, that was left blank. And that's what gave rise to the litigation, because there's an Iowa statute which says, and I've got it here in front of me, I won't read it, but I'll closely paraphrase it, that if the mother has been married at any time from conception to birth, if the mother has been married, then presumptively, the husband, and that's the term that is used in the statute, the husband is the father of that child, and that husband's name goes on the birth certificate as the father of the child, unless a court determines that someone else is the true father.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in the case of a single mother who has a sperm donor, what happens there if no second name is turned in?
And so there's no marriage at any point during
There's no marriage at any point. Yeah, I'm just sort of getting a theoretical there.
Sure. So if it's a single woman, she has not married at any time from conception to birth, then the father's name is left blank unless there's some judicial proceeding or other proceeding to establish who the father is.
But in this case, a partner was identified, obviously not the sperm donor, but the other mother. So what is the justification for the Iowa Department of Public Health deciding not to put that name on the birth certificate? I guess the statute you just quoted.
Yeah, it kind of two justifications. One, it starts with the language of the statute, and the Department of Public Health says the statute uses terms like husband and paternity, and says, well, it's obviously contemplating that it is a male whose name will go in that place on the birth certificate. And then when pressed to say, oh, well, you know, same-sex marriage is now legal, so how about listing the other spouse? The position the Department of Public Health has taken in this case is that these birth certificates serve a very important public health research purpose in tracking biological parentage. So it is very important for the state to know who the biological parents are, so that if they do research, for example, on autism, and they want to know, is there any correspondence between autism and, let's say, the age of the biological father, these birth certificates are a source of information. Mm-hmm. And so they say, we're going to stick with continuing to identify biological parentage, which is usually, though not always, usually what happens when a woman is married at some point during the conception to birth process, usually, though not always, is going to be the husband who's the biological father. So it's kind of the research integrity, the data integrity that the state is pointing to.
Now, something tells me also, perhaps by your tone of voice, that the purpose of the birth certificate really is at the crux here, and that that Melissa and Heather, the Gartners, do not agree entirely with this purpose.
No, they don't agree. They point to a wide range of other settings in life where birth certificates are either required or come in handy. So if you're traveling with a child through an airport, you may have to produce a birth certificate to show that this child properly belongs to you. They point to an experience that they themselves had when their daughter was young. She became critically ill at one point and was hospitalized for a period of time. And they argue that if both women's names had been on the birth certificate, then the hospital clearly would have let both women make important health care decisions. But because only one of the women's name was on the birth certificate, they felt that that birth mother whose name was on the certificate had to be there at the hospital at all times, and the other parent could not come in and take over and give the other one a break or a chance to go home. So whether it's, picking your kids up from school, enrolling them in school, a variety of settings. I say birth certificates are important for all these purposes, and you're denying us the ability to have the benefit of a birth certificate in all those other kinds of cases.
Okay. Ryan, let me get you in on this as well. Tell me about an aspect here that Todd hasn't mentioned.
Well, I think how the Attorney General has defended this case is very interesting. And the Attorney General is very in favor of same-sex marriage. In fact, he filed an amicus brief on behalf of the plaintiffs in DOMA and an amicus brief in the Supreme Court on behalf of the plaintiff in the Prop 8 case. But how they are defending this statute is they're saying, look, this is, as Todd said, about paternity, number one. But number two, we really do wish that Iowa's statutory scheme would catch up with Varnum and same-sex marriage. We do wish that there was a faster way for same-sex couples to establish legal guardianship. But this statute, as written, is about paternity. It's about biology, and the Constitution doesn't require, therefore, that we change it to include non-biological parents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Let's move on to the second civil case that we have in our sights here. Ryan, let me start off with you to tell us about a case that has garnered national attention. It was the case of the famously irresistible dental hygienist. Many of our listeners will remember this. Tell us the story behind Nelson v. Knight.
Yeah, well, this was all the talk around Christmas. The case was decided mid-December, and it begins in 1999 when Melissa Nelson was hired as a dental hygienist in the dentist's office of Dr. Knight. And I guess by all accounts, she was a very good dental assistant, but she also became very close with the doctor. The problem for her is that the doctor's wife also worked there, observed this, and didn't really care for it. And the doctor also had an attraction to the dental hygienist, and he told her so. And he told her so in a little bit of what we think maybe an inappropriate way. He made comments to her that, if she saw a bulge in his pants, that meant her clothes were too tight. And he made other comments like this.
And there was some out of office texting going on that was not business related.
Exactly. That's actually what then led to her termination. The Knights were on vacation, and there was some texting going on with Melissa, dental hygienist, and the doctor. And the wife found out, and she said, "This ends. This ends now. I want you to terminate her." Mm-hmm. So the doctor talked with his minister, and then met with Melissa, the hygienist, and said, "I'm sorry, but my wife says that it's time for you to go, and I fear that you are indeed a threat to our marriage because I am attracted to you, and so you're fired."
Right. Well, am I correct in remembering, too, that the termination was done in the presence of the pastor?
You are correct.
Were the four of them there, the wife, the dentist, the dental hygienist, and the pastor?
Yes, kind of like a group therapy, I guess.
Okay. Take us further. So this is really interesting because it may, on first glance, not be the question you think before the court that is actually before the court. Tell us, what are the questions?
Well, when you hear the facts about the inappropriate comments you made, I think everyone immediately jumps to sexual harassment. But that's not what happened here, because to have a sexual harassment claim, it has to be objectively inappropriate, which I think we can all agree that the comments that were made were probably objectively inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But also has to be subjectively inappropriate.
What does that mean?
Meaning Melissa had to think, yes, I don't like that. But as it turns out, she didn't mind. And she was still friends. She respected the doctor.
At least she never said that she minded.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't bring a sexual harassment complaint. Instead, she said that because you fired me because I was attractive, you would not have found me attractive but for the fact that I am a female. Therefore, that is gender discrimination. And a unanimous Iowa Supreme Court said, no, that is not. They said, look, this is about the personal feelings of one person, about the jealousy of a wife, about this one person. And in fact, the doctor hired all women, so it must not have been about her gender, but it was specific to her and his emotions for her.
Hmm. Does this case have any implications past this strange situation that garnered national attention? Does it have implications outside of our borders?
I doubt it. I think there are. The Iowa Supreme Court cited two cases that were somewhat similar, both going the same way.
Tell us about those.
Well, in each of those cases, both federal cases, the female employee had been flirting with the male boss, and again, the spouse was jealous, and the employee was terminated, and so they came out basically the same way that this case did. But those cases go back. I think one is 1993, and one is maybe the late 90s. So if you can only search through the database of cases and find three of them, you have to start thinking, well, this doesn't happen very often, or at least the facts aren't laid out like this very often. But it is definitely an interesting fact pattern, which of course drew the national and, as I understand, international attention. But perhaps the most interesting thing about this case is yet to come. On January 4 of this year, Melissa filed a petition for rehearing. Basically, what she said, the Iowa Supreme Court, I think you got it wrong, and I want you to change your mind. That's not unusual. People do that all the time. But unless there's some kind of fact that the court missed or case that the court missed, they almost never, and as far as I know, they have never changed their mind.
So why would you do that?
Well, that petition is still sitting there. It hasn't been answered yet. It hasn't been denied yet. So I can only imagine that someone has indeed changed their mind. So that will be unprecedented. The only new fact that we have is the attention that the case received in the press. So this is going to be very interesting to see how it comes down, and then we can have a debate about whether public opinion affects court cases again.
Mm. Todd Pettis, join us on this with your thoughts on this unusual case that garnered national attention.
Well, I'll use it first just as a vehicle to make a pitch for people to tune in more in ways I think they'll enjoy to kind of the day-to-day work of the Supreme Court. If you go on the Supreme Court of Iowa's website, it's a good website, and you will find there that you have access to video of the oral arguments in this case and any number of others. Now, you might have to look around just a little bit to find them, but it won't take too long as you know the name of the case you're looking for. This one, for example, is Nelson versus Knight. But you can go and you can see the attorneys make their arguments. It doesn't take very long. A given case maybe takes 40 or 45 minutes to argue. You see the justices. It gives you a good feel for it. And so, for example, when I was watching the recording of this oral argument, it had Paige Fiedler was the attorney for Melissa Nelson, and Stuart Cochran was the attorney for Dr. Knight, and I thought they both did a terrific job in their arguments. And Ms. Fiedler had, I thought, one of the best encapsulations of a case I had ever heard. You know, if a good encapsulation of a case and an argument is something that the justices are going to remember. Now, she ultimately lost the case, but as evidence of her good effort, her line was something like, you know, the only thing my client did wrong was have breasts and bring them with her to work. And, you know, the fact that my boss found distracting, you know, what am I supposed to do about that? I can't leave him at home.
Mm-hmm. But there must be some lessons here for people who run businesses, whether they be dentists or other businesses, about the circumstances under which you can get rid of an employee.
Yeah, that's true. And some legal lessons and some
perhaps
PR lessons. I mean, we're sitting here on public radio and we're using names and we're talking about this. And if Dr. Knight is listening, I would imagine he's not thrilled to hear this case being brought up again. And so the notoriety—
It's not winning him any new customers.
Well, the notoriety that these cases
perhaps
draw—
it is.
Again,
I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, this case drew national news. And so one lesson having nothing to do with the law is that if you fire somebody because you find them sexually attractive, and that's really the entirety of the story, you may be living with the story for quite a while in ways that you'll come to regret. So there's a PR lesson. And, you know, with respect to the law here has favored the employer. And so there's no real cautionary tale for the employer saying, you know, you better not become attracted to an employee, because if you do and then you wish to fire them, you can't do it. That's not what the case said. The case says if that's the entirety of the story, someone has become a threat to your marriage or sexual tension in the office that you've decided is counterproductive to the business and you want to let someone go as a result, that's permissible.
Mm. I wonder, you mentioned just a moment ago, Todd Pettis, about the opportunities we have these days that earlier generations did not have to really view court proceedings, listen to them, or even see them on videotape. And now, of course, the University of Iowa College of Law trains the newest generations of lawyers. Do you have people now coming in, young lawyers, saying, I mean, I'm wondering if a teen might be attracted to these types of things, and you get those people in their late teens or early 20s who said, you know, I've been interested in this all my life. I've been watching and listening to litigation.
I would say with respect to the students we have now, this clearly adds a dimension to their experience. And so I'm teaching a course in constitutional law with a group of terrific students this semester, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it. And many of them are at night going home and listening to the oral arguments and then talking and emailing about it. You can pull down little clips of the audio, and you really get a kind of a three-dimensional sense of the justices and the players in these cases, and they enjoy it.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment. We have Todd Pettis with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, Associate Dean for Faculty there, also a Chair in Civil Litigation. Song Richardson of the University of Iowa College of Law, we'll get to her because we're going to focus on criminal law in our second half hour. She's a professor of criminal law. And when we come back, we'll talk about two cases before the Iowa Supreme Court, a case that looks at the circumstances in which it's okay or not for law enforcement to act on an anonymous tip. Also another one. Ryan Copesman. Forgive me, Ryan. I believe I've been mispronouncing your last name. Is it Copesman, correct?
Copemans. Close enough.
Copemans. Okay, very good. We'll be back in just a moment with more of our look at what's before the Iowa Supreme Court. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, one of my guests, filmmaker and University of Iowa graduate Devin Terrell, will talk with her about her new documentary, An American Winter. It's a profile of eight families who were bumped out of the middle class during the Great Recession and have yet to regain economic security. That conversation tomorrow on this program. Today we're focusing on some high-profile cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. Of course, we know in the news, our nation's top court, the Supreme Court of the United States, is considering two pivotal cases, heard arguments this week concerning same-sex marriage. Well, the Iowa Supreme Court also grappling with major issues. We're going to those this hour. In the first half hour, we talked about some two civil cases, interesting civil cases, and that are before the court, have been before the court. And this half hour with our guests, we want to focus on the criminal side. Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Also, Song Richardson, professor of criminal law at the University of Iowa College of Law. And also joining us in our Des Moines studio, Ryan Kopmans. He's an attorney in Nyemaster Goods Litigation Department. That's in Des Moines. Also, you may know him if you're into this area as the editor and chief of the Iowa appellate blog On Brief. How do people find that blog, Ryan?
The URL is www.iowaappeals.com, and they can also get to it from Nyemaster Goods' website as well.
Okay. Let's move to two interesting criminal cases, and I want to turn to you, Song Richardson, for this. The State v. COIMA, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You are.
Okay. It's a case that asks under what circumstances it's okay for law enforcement to act on an anonymous tip. Tell us the story behind State v. COIMA.
So this is an interesting case and an interesting story. So we have a group of people, Leon COIMA and some high-profile friends, who participated in an annual charity golf event.
And where are we in the state?
We are in River City, I believe it is.
Okay.
Or
Riverside?
Riverside.
There we go.
And then
okay.
Dune, right? So they are attending a charity golf event.
All right.
And they decide that they want to have dinner at a steakhouse before driving home. But what they didn't know is when they went into the steakhouse, there was a gentleman there who had a grudge against one of the members of Mr. COIMA's group. So when the group decides to leave the steakhouse, this individual, who we find out later has been drinking for hours, decides to call up 911 and to report that, and this is almost a direct quote, that there are these huge money guys who think they can get away with anything. Then he describes to 911, without telling them who he is, he describes their car, the make and model of their car, and the registration. And then he says, and guess what? They're drunk. I know they're drunk. So Mr. COIMA and his group leaves the restaurant, and the police have been informed that there is a potential drunk driver out there. So they're on the lookout for the car, and they spot the car. They pull it over after following it for 6 blocks. Now, what's important here is that the officers did not notice any traffic infractions or any traffic violations.
No swerving or
nothing.
Something. Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. So they would not have pulled him over but for this anonymous tip reporting a drunk driver. So they pull the car over, Mr. COIMA's driving, and they smell alcohol. So they have him do some field sobriety tests, which he fails. Eventually,
he is drunk.
So he is actually drunk.
Legally
right? That's
drunk.
What makes
mm-hmm.
He's legally drunk. He blew a .08 in this particular case.
That's right at the level.
Right at the level, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so he's arrested. And it turns out, actually, that this is his second DUI. So the issue that's raised in this case is when you have an anonymous tip, and the anonymous tipster, you know nothing about this tipster. You don't know if he's lying. You know nothing about his credibility. And you also have no idea where he got his information. How does he know, for example, that Mr. COIMA or anyone in that car is actually drunk? So that's the question. So imagine, Ben, like
yeah.
you're to make
well,
it real
I'm imagining
for us.
Being that 911 service, and I would have a protocol for this anonymous tips, wouldn't I?
You would think it would be easy to ask, right? Who are you?
Yes.
And where did you get this information? But without doing that, if, for example, Ben, and this is not going to happen, I develop a grudge against you, right?
Okay.
I could
all
determine
right.
what car you drive, what your license plate is, what you're wearing on a particular day, and then I'd call 911 and say, guess what? Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio is drunk mm-hmm. In order to harass you, in order to get the police to stop you. So that's the question here. How much information should police have from an anonymous tipster before they can actually act on it?
And this is related to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. How?
Exactly. Because the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution says police cannot pull someone over to investigate a crime unless they have probable cause to believe you're committing a crime, or a lesser standard called reasonable suspicion. But in order to develop this reasonable suspicion, you have to have, especially with a tip, some basis for believing that the tip is true and that the tipster had some basis for believing you are actually committing a crime.
Mm-hmm. But in this case, we had – it was a grudge, but we have someone who is actually drunk, as it turns out, a second DUI.
Yes.
And so we have – don't we have public safety, public concern here that – wouldn't they be negligent in not pursuing this case?
That is exactly what the state of Iowa is arguing here. What they're saying is there are certain cases that are so dangerous that it's like a report that someone has a bomb. And so if we're dealing with dangerous cases like this, shouldn't we lower somewhat this indicia of reliability? Shouldn't we perhaps have police officers stopping people and not waiting until the driver actually drives erratically or causes an accident? This is a case of a dangerous crime.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, what is the Ryan Copemans, let me turn to you about what the court's doing in this case or has done.
Well, it held oral argument in Sioux City a few weeks ago, and this is part of their traveling road show that they've done since retention elections to try to get out in public more and have people see these arguments that Todd was talking about earlier. So they've now heard oral argument, and after watching that myself, I can say I think it's a very close case, and I don't know where the court's going to come down. Mm-hmm. They ask tough questions of both sides, didn't really tip their hand as to what way they're going, and I expect that this will be a late June decision, kind of like the DOMA and the Prop 8 case, in that there will probably be more than one decision. It'll probably be somewhat controversial and will come out at the very end of the term.
Mm-hmm. Is this purely a state thing, or is there any federal guidance at all about what you do with anonymous tips, Ryan?
Well, there's a very key U.S. Supreme Court case coming out of Florida where an anonymous tipster called in and said that there is a black man standing at a phone booth. He has a gun. Didn't say how they knew that the person had the gun. Tipster obviously didn't give their name. Police went to the phone booth. They saw a young man matching that description. He wasn't doing anything odd, but they stopped and they frisked him anyway. A unanimous Supreme Court said that that was unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. But Justice Ginsburg, who wrote the opinion, left open this proposition that Song talked about earlier about the bomb, about, okay, this guy has a gun. What's wrong with just watching him for a while, mm-hmm. seeing if he does anything unusual? If he does, then you can take him in. You can stop him before he pulls it out, before he causes any harm. But what happens if you get a report that someone is carrying a bomb and all it takes is a quick flip of a switch and they wipe out a block? Do you have to just stand there and wait for it?
Right. And we've seen enough episodes of 24 to know that that
yeah.
can happen, right?
Seven times, I think.
And we want Jack Bauer to act.
Yes. And so now the question is with drunk driving. And in fact, the Virginia Supreme Court, by a 4-3 vote, said that a search almost just like this was indeed illegal. That case was in petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the justices voted not to hear it. In what is kind of an unusual move, Chief Justice Roberts wrote a dissent from the denial of the decision to hear the case, and he was joined by Justice Scalia. And what Chief Justice Roberts said is this. He said, look, this is more like a bomb. The cop shouldn't have to follow this drunk driver and give them, quote, one free swerve before he pulls him over. Mm. This crime of drunk driving is happening continuously, and I would hate to have to tell the loved ones of someone who died from a drunk driver that we had a tip, we were following them, but we were just waiting for them to swerve into traffic.
But what about that? What about that concern about anyone who has a grudge launching one of these things? Song might do it with me, as she said here, coming up here in the coming months. I don't know. I'm going to be aware, but that has implications.
Oh yeah, absolutely a concern, and I think that's what makes this Iowa Supreme Court case so fascinating, because we have that extra fact where he said, you know, these big money guys from Mount Valley who think they can do whatever they want. What does that do to the reliability of the tip? And I think that's a question that the Iowa Supreme Court's going to have to grapple with, and it's not an easy one.
Okay, we want to move on to our final criminal case. If you've just joined us, we're talking about four high-profile cases this hour before the Iowa Supreme Court. We know the nation's Supreme Court has been in the limelight with those two same-sex marriage cases, but we wanted to focus on the work of the Iowa Supreme Court and some interesting decisions, narratives being explored there. Our final one is a case called State v. Ragland, and it concerns the Eighth Amendment. And Ryan, you start us off on this. Remind us, what is the Eighth Amendment? It has this well-known phrase, cruel and unusual punishment.
This is another case that actually spins off of a U.S. Supreme Court case. And last year, at the very end of the term, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that it was unconstitutional to sentence a juvenile murderer to life without the possibility of parole if that is a mandatory sentence. If the judge doesn't consider the facts of this particular defendant, the mitigating circumstances, the family life, if the jury says first-degree murder and the judge is forced to say life without the possibility of parole, that is unconstitutional. So that applies to Iowa because individuals who commit first-degree murder are indeed sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And if you are a juvenile who is tried as an adult, that applies to you.
So tell us the story of Jeffrey Ragland.
So Jeffrey Ragland started a fight back in 1986. Unprovoked, they saw him and a group of his friends saw another group of young men sitting in a parking lot of a grocery store. Approached them, started this fight. In that fight, one man died from being hit over the head with a tire iron. Ragland didn't strike the blow, but then he picked up the tire iron and chased Ragland's friends into the grocery store. He was convicted of felony murder, and therefore first-degree murder, and sentenced to life without parole. 2 years after that, he took his case all the way up to the Iowa Supreme Court. He said, "That is, my life sentence is cruel and unusual." The Iowa Supreme Court, in one paragraph, said, "No, absolutely not. We're not going to bother getting into sentencing policy." Mm-hmm. Then you fast forward more than 20 years, and this U.S. Supreme Court decision has now changed everything. So now Ragland's sentence would indeed be unconstitutional. But step in the executive branch. Governor Branstad agreed, I guess you could probably say, with the dissenters in Miller versus Alabama, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, which was 5-4. And Branstad said, like the dissenter said in that case, "I think sentencing policy should be done at the political level, the legislature, the executive branch." And so our legislature has said life without the possibility of parole. They made that public policy decision. So I'm going to keep Ragland's sentence as close to that as I can without conflicting with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision. So he vacated or he commuted Ragland's sentence to life with the possibility of parole at 60 years. And he did that with 37 other juvenile murderers in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So now Ragland is going back up to the Supreme Court and he's saying, "Look, 60 years, that means I'm going to be, 77 when I have the first chance for parole. That is effectively a life sentence. Therefore, it's still unconstitutional under the U.S. Supreme Court decision." And that's what the Iowa Supreme Court's going to consider next month.
Okay, so Song, let me turn to you. The courts can rule in this case. What are the options?
So one option is to determine whether or not this 60-year mandatory sentence is actually cruel and unusual punishment. And if the court believes that it is, then the U.S. Supreme Court has said Mr. Ragland is entitled to a sentencing hearing. He's entitled to have a court look at his age at the time of the crime because juveniles are different. They can be rehabilitated, and so they should have the opportunity to present evidence of his youth. And what's interesting in the history of this case is Jeffrey Ragland did have a resentencing hearing in front of the district court. And what the district court found was the district court said, "I'm not going to follow Governor Branstad's commutation order. I think that his order is in violation of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Miller. And so I'm going to resentence you, Jeffrey Ragland, and I'm going to sentence you to the possibility of parole after serving 25 years. So he, the district court, ignored Governor Branstad's order. And what's interesting, I'll add one additional fact to this case, or two additional facts. So the two individuals who were charged with this crime originally, with Jeff Ragland, who was 17 at the time, the actual killer is out. He received a sentence. He pled guilty to second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He's now out. He has two kids and a successful career in insurance. The second defendant, who had the exact same involvement in this crime as Jeffrey Ragland, he pled guilty too. He only served 60 days in custody and then went to college, has two kids, and also has a successful career. And finally, the prosecutor in this case, who prosecuted Mr. Ragland, he testified at the resentencing hearing saying Mr. Ragland has served enough time.
Well, this inequities would seem to anyone just listening to play a major role here. So what is the role that is what you just pointed out, Song?
Exactly. And that's the issue here, right? Should Jeffrey Ragland have the ability to have a mitigation sentencing hearing, or can the governor come in and exercise his executive commutation power and say, no, you don't have a right to a hearing, we're sentencing you to 60 years, and that's not life.
And your idea, what will happen here, Song? And then, to you, Ryan, your thoughts on
I'm glad you're going first.
Thanks, Ryan.
The crystal ball gazing starts. Go ahead.
Oh, boy. So I'm going to hedge a little bit here and say that what's fascinating about this case, I think, one issue is the separation of powers issue, right? Can the court, can the judiciary tell Governor Branstad, you can't do this, right? So there's a real fight here, a real separation of powers fight. And I'm fascinated to see what the court is going to do.
Okay, you're fascinated. You're going to leave it at that.
I am, Ryan.
Ryan, are you going to venture into territory to predict here?
I'm also fascinated. I think it'll be interesting to watch the oral argument and to see what kind of questions are asked. I think you will probably see Justice Apple, who has been kind of an advocate in favor of tougher scrutiny on these kinds of sentences, on juvenile sentences and on longer sentences in general. You'll see him pressing the state very hard. And on the opposite end, I think it's important to watch maybe Justice Mansfield and Justice Waterman, who tend to be a little more deferential to the legislature. If you don't see them being deferential, you know this case is definitely going for Ragland. But my guess is that even after the oral argument, we'll have to wait and see till the end of June.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to finish up there with Song?
I just wanted to add one more thing.
Sure.
That this case also, I think, has national implications.
Sure.
Because there are about, in addition to Iowa, there are about 39 other states who are going to be in the same position of having to give juveniles resentencings. And so if the Iowa Supreme Court decides that Governor Branstad has this power to issue this type of blanket commutation order, then we may see governors in other states doing the same things to try to avoid the implications of Miller versus Alabama.
Does it matter what the family of the deceased, the murdered person in this case, feels about this at all in such a case?
It shouldn't matter to what the Iowa Supreme Court does, but certainly I think it's hard not to be affected by what they think. And I know that a member of Jeffrey Ragland's family has been in communication with the victim's family. Timothy Seif is his name, or Seif is the victim's name, and they have been in contact with the family, but the family has not, as far as I am aware currently, said anything in terms of what should happen in Jeffrey Ragland's case.
Ryan, you wanted to finish up there?
Yeah, that will obviously, the family's input will obviously be very important if he does indeed get resentencing. If the Iowa Supreme Court says, yes, 60 years is too long, you need to go back for sentencing, that input will be incredibly important at resentencing and at his eventual parole hearing.
Fascinating cases here that we've been looking at this hour. Of course, they all have anything to do with real people, real families. So we have a little bit of jocularity in the studio, I think, here. But it is worthy to remember that, you know, these are all families, people, and we have to keep that in our thoughts, too, on all these cases. Been fascinating to talk about. Let's circle back just 1 minute that we have remaining to the two same-sex marriages cases that we have before the Supreme Court case. We had very high-profile reporting on this nationwide. Also, before that, some months ago, the deliberation on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Some call it Obamacare. a lot of attention. I want to finish up with you, Todd Pettis. Is this unusual? Is this precedented that the Supreme Court in such rapid succession would be thrown into the spotlight, a very intense spotlight?
Yeah, we have each year the court sits, we call it a term with a capital T. We have quiet terms and we have very active terms. This is a very active term. We have a high-profile voting rights case, a high-profile affirmative action case, the University of Texas. We've got these two same-sex marriage cases. And as you said, just we're not yet 12 months past the decision in the healthcare case. The Supreme Court has really been in the front of the public's mind, in the front of, in the foreground, in the news, and you know there are stretches of time where that's not the case.
And then there's some tension between the Chief Justice and the President.
There is. That really came up in oral arguments this week. Very quickly, the President's taking the view that he thinks DOMA is unconstitutional, but he's going to keep enforcing it. Chief Justice Roberts says, why doesn't he have, quote, the courage of his convictions?
And that's unusual to have that firing back and forth between the president, the head of the executive branch, and the head of the judicial branch.
That's correct.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. We have to. Our time is done. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty in the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of College of Law. Song Richardson, Professor of Criminal Law at the College of Law at the University of Iowa, and Ryan Kopmans. He's an attorney in Nye Master Goods Litigation Department, editor-in-chief of the Iowa Appellate Blog On Brief. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Song and Todd.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. We'll hope you tune in again tomorrow.